Hi, everybody. This is God's Side for the Sad Truth. Today, I have another fantastic guest. Martin Kulldorff is a biostatistician and epidemiologist, and until very recently, a professor at Harvard University Med School of Medicine. Martin, how you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you? Nice talking to you.
Likewise, likewise. I know that you are one of the three co-authors of the great Barrington Declaration. Maybe you can start us off with that, and then we could talk about your Harvard debacle. And we can also talk about the fact that we're both Cornelians. So go ahead, take it away.
Okay, yeah. So in early 2020, the world went mad, and all the principles of public health were thrown out the window. And as the public health scientist, I was in shock. And I tried to publish here in the US, but it was very difficult during the spring and summer of 2020. I had no problems publishing in my native Sweden in the major newspapers there. But here I couldn't get my voice heard because I figured it was important to tell people that, well, anybody can get infected. There's more than a thousandfold difference in the risk between the old and the young. So the obvious thing is to do as much as we can to protect older people because they are higher risk while letting kids go to school. But anybody who tried to speak out was sort of dismissed somehow. Either they were only one person or they didn't have the right expertise or whatever. So I got together with Dr. Jay Bhattacharya from Stanford University and Dr. Sunetha Gupta from Oxford University, who is the preeminent infectious disease immunologist in the world. And we wrote the one-page Great Barrington Declaration arguing for focused protection. We need to do more to protect older people, and we should let kids go to school, and we should not have all these other lockdown measures because they are not effective against COVID, and they create a lot of collateral public health damage on cancer or cardiovascular disease or mental health and so on.
So I don't know if you know the answer to this, but as someone who studied the parasitic mind, hence this book, right? Why do people get parasitized by bad thinking, bad ideas, idea pathogens? What in your view explains that reticence to hear your voice? So for example, when it comes to, let's say, transgender activism and the men too can menstruate, I can offer an analysis as to why there is that departure from reason. But when it's coming from fellow public health officials, whom you're saying were violating all the fundamental tenets of, good public health thinking, what was driving, from your view, their departure from reason?
That's a very good question. I have asked that myself many, many times, and I have certain theories. I don't have any
Sure, take it away.
answers that I know. But if we look, for example, at the leadership, which was NIH Director Francis Collins and NIAID Director Anthony Fauci and Deborah Birx, who was the COVID coordinator at the White House during 2020. They are lab scientists. They know about biology, they know about immunology, but they don't know much about public health, and that was obvious. They didn't understand that you can't just focus on one disease, COVID, and ignore all the collateral damage. They don't understand that, a hurricane will come, and you can hunker down for a while, and then it's over, and you can go back out in the sun. That's not how infectious diseases work. If you hunker down, well, you might not get infected for those 2 weeks. But when people start going out again, the infection will just take off instead. So you can push it forward a little bit, but you cannot prevent it. You have to go through it. It's like COVID is like influenza. There's no way to stop it. And as soon as we had the outbreaks outside of China, it was first in northern Italy and Iran. It was obvious to any clear-thinking epidemiologist that this would hit the whole world. This virus will spread to the whole world sooner or later. It's just inevitable.
So I don't know if you're being charitable or if that's really truly your position. You seem to be attributing all of the weight of the bad decisions on ignorance, right? But let me force you to sort of attribute points to two possible scenarios. One is what you suggested, which is, look, they're not public health officials, and so they were imbecilic in their approach to this thing. So that would be 100%. It's only ignorance. Another one, slightly more dark, or a lot more dark, is that no, there is willful duplicity, whether it is political, whether who knows, whether it's machinations at Davos. So if I ask you to allocate 100 points to these two factors, 75 points go to ignorance, 25 points go to diabolical machinations. How would you attribute those points to those two differing factors?
Maybe I'll give 25 out of 100 to both of those two, and then I leave 50 for something else.
What's the 50 for
And
something else?
that's overconfidence in themselves, hubris. They
Yes.
thought they were right, and because of that, they censored other people. So a fundamental principle of science, of the Age of Enlightenment that we have been lived with for a few hundred years now, is an open exchange of ideas and freedom of speech, and in terms of universities, academic freedom, and that was shut down. So even if they were ignorant about public health, that's an excusable thing because we don't know about everything. But it's completely inexcusable to shut down the debate. So when we came out with the Great Barrington Declaration, the NIH director at the time, Francis Collins, he asked for a devastating takedown. What he should have done if he was a true scientist was to ask for passionate debates.
Amazing.
Invite us and invite some people who are pro-lockdowns, and we'll just have an open public discussion. That's what he should have had. So I would put 50% to that and 25% of the other two, maybe. But who knows? I mean, that's just.
No, I understand we're speculating, but so to your point about the 50 points, the sort of the ego and the hubris and the inability to autocorrect in light of new evidence. I've been mentioning this quite often because it's a question that recently arose on a show that I appeared on, hosted by a British psychiatrist, where towards the end of our chat, he asked me, "Well, Professor Saad, you've been a behavioral scientist now for 3 decades. You've been a professor for 3 decades. What is the singular phenomenon that has most surprised you about human nature?" Which I thought, on the one hand, it's a very basic question. On the other hand, it's actually quite a profound question because I have studied a lot about human nature. And so I had to kind of pause for a moment to hopefully offer him a good answer. And very quickly, the top answer to your point about your 50 points factor, I said, probably the thing that surprises me most about human nature is the inability of people to change their opinions once it is deeply anchored somewhere. And the reason why I was so surprised by that, because in the parasitic mind, I'm arguing that there is an objective epistemological way to seek truth. I mean, beyond just the scientific method, I talk about nomological networks of cumulative evidence, where I can build you a network of evidence stemming from across species, across time periods, across cultures. So it's like an orgiastic triangulation method that really drowns you in a tsunami of evidence to hopefully prove my point, which is exactly how any serious scientist should think. And yet, I also argue in that chapter that regrettably, despite the fact that I've got this mind vaccine for you, most people are going to go, la, 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 I don't want to hear it, including Francis Collins and so on. So which leads me to think that it is a fundamental feature of the architecture of the human mind not to seek truth, but rather, to your point, to win arguments, which is something that two French psychologists argued in their book on why has reasoning evolved. And they specifically said, it's got nothing to do with seeking truth. It's got to do with me winning arguments. So basically, that's your 50 points.
Yeah, that's depressing. And I mean, if that's the case, that's the death of science. We are then at end of the scientific period, and I mean we had the Greek period, and then we had the Arab period, and then we had the Western European, the US period of the three golden ages of scientific discovery. But maybe that's come to an end, and then we'll have to wait a few hundred years for the next one. I don't know.
Oh
But
boy, that's pessimistic.
it's sort of a depressing thought, because science cannot survive if the point is to win arguments. Science can only survive if we are sort of humble and we are seeking the truth. And to me, as a scientist, like when I do a study, it's really exciting because, okay, I do this study. I don't know if A is true or B is true. That's so exciting to sort of be the first one to know.
That's amazing. So,
That's
okay.
to me, that's the fascination with science, that we don't know and we try to know. And my actually I got my PhD at Cornell, like you know, and my thesis advisor there told me one thing. He said that the foundation of science and scientific research is ignorance.
Yes. Well, and
And
it
at first, that seems strange because you need to know stuff, but it actually is because we have to be ignorant then to search the truth.
Yes, and I want to talk about Cornell in a second because I think we have a lot of intersections that are worth exploring. So all over me now, I'm in my study at home. I have a gigantic personal library of books. To my anxiety and dismay, there are many of those books that I've yet to read, and periodically, probably maybe once every week or 2 weeks, I start calculating, if I read one of those books, per week, do I have enough of a lifespan left? God willing, I have a long life ahead that I can finish those books. So to your point, I think and it sounds like a cliche, but I think it's truly true that the more you know, actually you're humbled by how little you know, right? So on the one hand, I could walk around
Exactly.
saying, my God, I know more than certainly 99.9% of people that are walking the earth. That's not how I look at it. I actually compare myself to the knowledge that is out there, and then I say, I'm an idiot. There's so much things that I don't know, and I think any serious scientist has to have that epistemic humility.
Do you think this scientist or others, do they think they have a fear to acknowledge that they don't know something and just says, I don't know?
I think it takes someone who is truly self-confident in their personhood to say, I don't know. So I'll give you a personal example to that. So, I've been in the public eye for many years now, years, and so there are all sorts of ways by which I could have fumbled an answer somewhere where it got me into trouble and so on. And many people have asked me, what is it about you that makes you so uncancelable, knock on wood, so far? And one of the answers I give to the point of what we're talking about now is that I'm very well calibrated about what I know and what I don't know. So that if you ask me a question about, the evolutionary roots of some phenomena that is a human universal, I've already built the requisite nomological network of cumulative evidence. And so if I come to that debate, good luck to you. On the other hand, you can ask me a million questions about things that I don't know too much about, and I'll never try to wing it. I'll never try to phone it in. So I'll say, Martin, that's a great question that you're asking me about, the pros and cons of legalization of marijuana, but I just don't know enough about it to offer you a really intelligent answer. By me doing that, I actually build trust. So imagine you're sitting with an undergraduate class where they come into the class thinking you're the all-knowing professor, and then you tell the 21-year-old who just asked you a question, wow, what a great question. I don't know the answer to that. Send me an email and I'll look into it. That immediately gives you credibility because the students are saying, well, this guy is not haughty. He actually admits when he doesn't know something. So to your original question, I think, the ego is a very, very nasty beast. And most people are unwilling to admit, and certainly not the Francis Collins of the world to say, I don't know. That's like a death nail to their ego.
That's very interesting you says that because that's kind of my experience because unlike you, I haven't been in the public eye before the pandemic. And so I was sort of thrown into this after the Great Parental Declaration doing interviews. People will sometimes ask me a question and I would answer it, but then sometimes they ask me something I didn't know what the answer was. So I would just say, well, I don't know. And sometimes I'll say, I don't know because somebody else, I don't really know, expert in that area, or sometimes say, I don't know because really nobody knows. And I realized that that actually, as you said, that increases the confidence in the things that I do say about. So I didn't do it purposely, but by accident, I sort of just started doing that because I tried to be honest, and that was a good thing.
Right. So did you, so you may or may not have heard the metaphor that I use when I ask implore people to activate their inner honey badger. And here what I'm talking about is, you may or may not know, Martin, that the honey badger has been ranked as the most ferocious animal in the animal kingdom. It's the African honey badger is the size of, maybe a small dog. And yet it is so ferocious that, all the animals in that neighborhood are afraid of it. I mean, including adult lions, they don't mess with the honey badger. And so when I ask people to activate their inner honey badger, I'm basically saying, be combative. If you have principles on which you can stand and that you can defend, don't walk away. Don't be a coward. Now, clearly, whether you knew it or not before COVID, you've certainly become a honey badger. Maybe that's not what you meant to do, but you said, "Hey, I'm not going along with this." Were there any hints that you were a honey badger earlier in your career, or is this something that you've only discovered since the COVID world about yourself?
Well, I don't think I'm the person who sort of attacks people, but maybe I have a honey badger when it comes to protecting
The
people
truth.
and doing yeah. So in depending both the truth, the scientific truth, which I care a lot about, and also people's lives and their livelihoods and their well-being. So after I got my PhD at Cornell, I actually did not go to do academics immediately. I went to work as a human rights observer in Guatemala. Where I was, so basically, there was a military dictatorship there that were killing people, disappearing people. So these brave Guatemalans, if they had a Westerner with them, as protective accompaniment, not with the gun but with the camera, that sort of kept them safer because obviously these death squads wanted to operate in the dark. So I guess that's one instance where I sort of took some risk myself to protect. So maybe that's my inner honey badger in that
So
sense.
there were hints of the honey badger mindset early in your career. What then led you to leave that work and say, okay, I'm going back into academia?
Well, I was only supposed to do that for a while, and then I had to sort of start my own life. And I love science. I love the curiosity. Basically, every child is a scientist.
Right.
They're exploring the world and doing experiments. And to be a scientist, a true scientist, is like being a child your whole life. And that's a wonderful thing,
I love that you
exploring
said
things
this.
and
Forgive me for interrupting you. I'm very, very sorry for interrupting you. So, in my latest book on happiness, I have an entire chapter that I titled Life as a Playground. And in that chapter, I argue that the highest form of play is science because it is the ultimate, excuse me, puzzle making, right? I mean, in a puzzle, you're taking a bunch of pieces, see what fits where. Well, what's science? There's a million variables floating around. And now I need to see, does this variable cause this one, or is it the other way, or are they not right? So I love the science as play metaphor. I love that.
yeah. So, yeah, I like what you said. Thank you.
Okay, so I want to come back to Cornell in a second because in looking at your bio, I think there might be links between your doctoral training and actually my doctoral dissertation. So I'm going to keep you intrigued for a moment or two. But before we come to Cornell, we have to talk about what happened at Harvard. So you joined Harvard, I think, in the early two, is it 2001 or 2003? When did you join Harvard?
I think 2003, probably.
Okay,
I
and you
joined
were
Harvard.
there until very recently. You were a tenured professor?
Yeah, I was a full professor, so they call it with indefinite duration. That's what they call it.
Okay, so indefinite duration is another term for tenure, or it's a different process? Because I'm trying to
I think
understand
it.
how they can get rid of you if you had the tenure protection.
I don't know. So I think it's at least similar to tenure. So.
Okay, so then you're there. You're obviously, I mean, I checked your Google Scholar metrics. It's certainly you weren't a slouch. It's not as though you weren't being productive. I think, I don't know, an H index of 80 or something like that. So for the people who don't know what that is, it's a pretty impressive, well, not only publication record, but also in terms of the influence of that, of the publications. So it's certainly not because, you know, you were deadwood that we need to get rid of you. So what happened? Walk us up. I mean, are you allowed to talk through the story, or is it in litigation, or is am I not allowed to
No,
ask you?
I can say whatever I want.
Okay, so go ahead. So tell us what happened.
So first of all, I never had any problems with my close colleagues that I work with at Harvard. They were all very good, and a lot of them agree with me on the pandemic. So there was never any personal problems with any of my colleagues. The leadership, both at Harvard's Mass General Hospital, as well as Harvard Medical School, they were not too happy with the Great Barrington Declaration. So they were struggling how to deal with me. And I guess, and there was two people who tried to set up a debate with me and other Harvard faculty who was in favor of lockdowns and school closures. And I said yes, of course, but there was no takers on the other side. So there was no debate or discussion about this at Harvard. So one thing that we disagreed about is immunity. So if you've had an infection, you have immunity. That's how the immune system works. And we've known that for 2,500 years since the Athenian plague in 430 BC. And for example, the hospital, you will have nurses. They worked at the hospital. They took care of COVID patients. They got infected. They stayed home for a few weeks. They recovered. They go back taking care of more COVID patients. And then the hospital administrators fired them because they didn't take the vaccine. Even though they had superior immunity compared to those who took the vaccine. So when I was so they instituted a vaccine mandate, and I had already had COVID. I also have an immune deficiency that's genetic, alpha 1 antitrypsin deficiency. So I think it would have been very unwise for me to take the vaccine. But also it was completely unscientific and unethical, because I mean there are problems with these vaccines, but suppose it was the perfect vaccine. When there's a vaccine shortage, you shouldn't give it to people who don't need it because they already had COVID. You should give it to like my 87-year-old neighbor who hadn't gotten it yet because there was a vaccine shortage, or people in Asia or Africa or Latin America where they had shortage of vaccines. So it would have been unethical for me also to take the vaccine for that reason. So they did give exemptions to a number of faculty members, but my medical exemption was denied, and I also did a religious exemption, which I didn't expect to be granted, but that was also denied. But I think they should have accepted my medical exemption request.
Okay, so then that happened, but that happened a few years ago, right?
So that happened from Mass General Brigham. So they fired me, and then Harvard University put me on leave for 2 years. And then a few months ago, they ended the leave. So the firing actually sort of happened a little over 2 years ago. And then a few months ago, they put me on leave. And then I think said, well, now I'm not affiliated with Harvard anymore, so I can sort of go public with what happened.
Wow. And so do you, again, I don't know if you're comfortable answering this. Is there a pathway for a lawsuit that's forthcoming in the future?
Well, I haven't really decided. I mean, I'm from Sweden, and we don't really do those things. I do have another lawsuit going, which is called Missouri versus Biden, or Murphy versus
Yes.
Missouri. So I'm one of five co-plaintiffs. So there's two states, Missouri and Louisiana, and then we are five private co-plaintiffs who were censored by social media at the behest of the government. So. The temporary injunction was up at the Supreme Court actually on Monday, heard the oral arguments, and they will decide probably by June sometime.
Well, now, do you forgive the ignorance of the legal question here? When it goes up in front of the Supreme Court, do you actually serve as a witness, or is it only the lawyers who take on the case that are your voice, or do you actually address the court?
No, so I wrote a written testimony under oath of what happened to me, Then the lawyers, they write the briefs because I don't know constitutional law. I strongly believe in the First Amendment, but I can't write those briefs. And then there's one of the attorneys who is arguing in front of the Supreme Court. So
And do
I don't have to argue in front of the judges, which I will be completely incompetent at doing so.
Wow. So how long does that process take to unfold? I mean, when will there be a bottom line to that process?
So the interesting thing is that we had the discovery and the deposition, and we deposited Anthony Fauci, for example, and asked him many questions and for 7 hours. And during those 7 hours, I think there was 170 times that his answer was, "I don't remember." So he didn't remember much of what happened during the pandemic, poor fellow. But that discovery and depositions was actually quite useful because that's what's unearthed the magnitude of the government, federal government's involvement in the censoring of the social media companies. And then later on, we also got the Twitter files with added to that. And of course, that was more public. And we won. So we then filed a request for a temporary injunction, which means while this goes on in the court, it will take several years. We don't want the government to coerce social media companies. They should stop now. So we won that case in the district court in Louisiana. They issued their verdict on July 4th last year. I'm not quite sure why they picked July 4th, but I don't think it was an accident. And then early fall or late summer, the federal court, they appealed it. So we won that case in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeal. It was unanimous by the judges. And then the federal government appealed it to the Supreme Court. And the name was then changed from Missouri versus Biden to Murphy versus Missouri. And that's what the oral arguments was heard just a while ago. And
Why is it Missouri and Louisiana? What's the link with those two states? Why those two versus others? How does that work?
it was the attorney generals of those two states that filed it.
Oh,
And
I
they
see.
filed it on behalf of their citizens who when you violate the First Amendment, you violate free speech. So when I'm censored, okay, I'm a victim, but actually other people are more victims because they don't get to hear all the information they potentially could hear. So
Interesting.
I want to hear what you have to say. So if they censor you, well, that's bad to you, but it's actually bad to me also because I can't hear what you're saying.
So by
So
them
they.
censoring you in Boston, you're not in Missouri, you're not in Louisiana, but there is some prospective audience member in Louisiana or Missouri that could have heard the voice of Martin that was suppressed, and therefore I can come in as the attorney general of those states and sue on their behalf.
Correct. So they are suing on behalf of the citizens, but then we are five co-plaintiffs who were censored, including one from Louisiana. Jill Hines, but it's myself, it's Dr. Aaron Curiati,
Of
who
course.
was fired by UC Irvine, and then Dr. Jay Bhattacharya at Stanford, and then one journalist, Jim Huft. So those are the five private plaintiffs.
Well, you know, it gives me great pride to so Cariarty and Jay have become good friends. They actually served as blurbers, endorsers on my last book on happiness. And
Oh,
so
great.
I am in great company here. Speaking of suppression, of course, on social media platforms, over the past while, Elon Musk and I have developed a very nice bromance. And I've often said that of all of Elon's, astonishing achievements in his life, in my view, none will be historically as important as him having bought Twitter. Do you agree with that, or do you think it's hyperbolic on my part?
No, I agree with that.
Right. I mean, because some people said, really, you think that's the bigger? You don't think Mars? You don't think, saving the climate with Tesla? You don't. I said, N not nothing. I mean, it sounds like a cliche at this point, but nothing is as important as freedom of speech. And certainly, as someone who comes from the Middle East, I can really appreciate that. Okay, let's switch now.
I
Yeah,
think
go
that's
ahead.
very true. And during the pandemic, I was kind of in an interesting position because in the US, I was on the fringe. According to Francis Collins, I was a fringe epidemiologist that had to be devastated takedown against me and my colleagues. But I'm a native of Sweden, and Sweden was the only major Western country who did not lock down, kept schools open, and so on. So there, I was actually in the mainstream. And when Sweden was heavily criticized internationally, but also by a group of 22 scientists. Only one of them was an infectious disease immunologist, but there was also like a mathematician, an oncologist, a climate scientist, and so on. But they were very harshly pushing against the Swedish system. So I was writing in support of what Sweden was doing against them. But I'm very, so I didn't like what they said. I was against what they said. But not only do I think that they should say it, I'm really happy that they did.
Right.
Because since they were thinking these things, there were obviously other people in Sweden who were thinking similarly. I was asking questions. So by actually taking the effort and time to write it down and send it to the major newspapers, they sort of voiced those concerns that was there. And then I and others had an opportunity to respond to them in the newspapers. So I completely disagree with them, but I'm very, very grateful that they actually spoke up and that we could have that discussion and debate because it allowed me and others to sort of counter it and explain why Sweden was doing it the right way. So I like to thank them for doing that. And I think that's the attitude we should have. If somebody has a different viewpoint on whatever, we should thank them for expressing it so that we can have that discussion and debate.
Has anyone who was vehemently against your position, so to my earlier point about the most surprising thing about human nature is the fact of people not being willing to, revise their positions in light of incoming new evidence, has anyone who was very much your detractor come back to you privately or publicly and said, "Dear Martin, boy, you were right. Apologies," or is the orgiastic hubris still undefeated?
Among the prominent advocates for lockdowns, nobody has
No
done
one.
that.
Amazing.
Among other people, there are people who were sort of privately or within their own group were in favor of lockdowns, and they sort of acknowledged, "Well, I'm right, and I was wrong, and you're right." So there's been quite a few of those, and some did it privately, and some actually did it publicly. So I mean, that very honors them a lot. I think that they do that.
But that speaks to the fact that it is very much ego driven because the more prominent I am, the more public I was, the more the Francis Collins and Fauci I am, the less likely I am to deviate from my original position because of the hubris, because of the ego. So that I think perfectly fits with what we're talking about.
So I think I've heard sort of through the grapevine that Francis Collins regretted calling us fringe epidemiologists, but he hasn't reached out personally. And I also know that he publicly at one point stated only a few months ago saying that, well, we made a mistake by only focusing on COVID. We should have looked at the collateral damage to other public health. So he sort of has acknowledged that he didn't get everything right, but there's been no sort of more no personal connect contacts and but I think that in the back of their minds they realized that things didn't go very well.
So that's a perfect segue. I mean, both we'll talk about Cornell, but let's talk about operations research, which because you said, oh, now we realize that we shouldn't have only focused on deaths and COVID, which is a very nice way to set up the idea of when you are trying to maximize or minimize an objective function, you could be trying to maximize or minimize a singular variable, or you understand that there are multiple variables that need to be minimized or maximized subject to certain constraints. So I think for any intelligent person, that should be obvious. But I think if you have been trained in the framework of operations research, where that is a fundamental framework by which you set up problems, it makes you less likely to have succumbed to the singular variable myopic focus. Do you think that that's true? Do you think it's just, in other words, do you think that your training as an operations research specialist inoculated you against the single variable bias?
Yes, operations research is how you use mathematics to optimize various functions in many variables. So I had never thought of that, but I think that's a very interesting, and I have to agree with you that might have been quite helpful. I mean, I always thought of it as in terms of the foundations of public health, and is it that you don't just optimize one thing, you have to look at it all. So I always thought of it as that, but I think that's quite interesting. Maybe that was very useful education for the pandemic back in the 80s in Cornell. So yeah,
Well, I mean,
I like that analogy. Yeah.
oh, thank you. Look, I always knew, I mean, there were two things that I was really interested in my life. You may not know my personal history, so I'll mention it for you and for some of the viewers who may not know. I was a very good soccer player, and so I wanted to continue in my soccer career. And I was always, from a child, I said, I want to become a professor. I wasn't sure in exactly what, but the thought of, professors seemed like superheroes to me, and that's what I wanted to do. So I always knew that that's what I was going to become. And so as I entered my undergraduate, I thought, okay, well, if I'm going to spend my entire career solving problems, irrespective, I didn't know what it was going to be in. There were several possibilities. What is the discipline that I should study in my undergrad as the foundation of anything else, irrespective of whether I go on in those fields or not? And I decided in my undergrad to do an undergrad in mathematics and computer science. And then even all the way up, so in my MBA, I did an MBA, then I went to Cornell to do my MS and PhD. But in my MBA, I did a mini thesis in operations research on something called the two-dimensional cutting stock problem. When I got to Cornell, one of my doctoral committee members, I wonder if you know him, was a very famous statistician at Cornell named Ali Hadi. Do you know him?
He wasn't there in the department. I was there, but I know who he is, yeah.
Right, okay. And I can't imagine that I would have gotten the same cerebral training, right? I mean, I don't I, it has been a very long time since I solved the differential equation, and it's been a very long time since I did a triple integral.
Same with
But
me.
exactly, but that training, right? I mean, when you're training as a soccer player, you also do sit-ups. Well, it's not because your abs are going to kick the ball. It's because the body has to be fully in shape. And
Yeah.
therefore, having that training, whether it be the OR part or more generally the super technical analytic part, has to have helped me, irrespective of what my innate intelligence was. And so when I now tell my children, they're still teenagers, I just keep saying math, 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 math all day long. It doesn't matter what you become later. Some of the most famous academic psychologists all have the exact same background. They all did undergrads in mathematics. Amos Tversky, Daniel Kahneman, all those Nobel Prize winners all had math degrees. So having said all that, and obviously you have a PhD in an applied mathematics field, do you think I'm overselling the math angle, or are these good advice to give to our youngsters?
No, I think you're underselling it because all the things that you said is true, but there's also one other thing. Math is lots of fun. It's a fantastic thing to do.
It really is. Okay, let's talk about Cornell. So you got there. I'm trying to think if we overlap. I don't think so. You were there from when to when?
From 84 to 88.
Ooh, I just missed you. I got there in 1990, and I finished everything in 94. Now, here's where, remember earlier I said that there might be some overlap even in some of the technical stuff that we did. Or maybe not. I saw, I think, in your either in your dissertation or in some of the publications post your dissertation, the term sequential sampling and so on. Was that right?
Yeah, I've done work on sequential analysis, which is a branch of mathematics, which is actually used a lot in medicine.
The
So it's a
reason.
very practical area of mathematics and statistics, very, very important in the health sciences.
The reason why I'm smiling, because now my inner geek is coming out, because my doctoral dissertation, I think you will know the word, the specific individual. Maybe some of our listeners won't, so we can explain it to them. I'm assuming you're familiar with Abraham Wald.
Oh yeah, he laid the foundation for sequential analysis back in
Oh
the
my God, I'm
1940s.
okay. Geek alert, everyone. We're about to enter into a geek zone. So let me explain to you, Martin, what my doctoral dissertation was on, and then we'll see where that takes us. So my doctoral dissertation was on binary sequential choice, where sort of the genesis of the framework comes from Abraham Wald with his sequential analysis, right? Sampling itself can be a random variable where you reach a threshold of evidence that you no longer need to sample additional information. It's used in statistical decision theory. How much do I need to acquire evidence to either prove that a manufacturing system is defective or not? So I took all that stuff, right? So you've got the again, I'm not explaining this to you. I'm explaining it to our audience, and then you can fill in. And so I took this idea that a lot of contexts where there are decisions being made, you're trying to reach a stopping threshold that allows you to say, I have now seen enough evidence to stop acquiring additional information. And so I took that framework and I did a doctoral dissertation demonstrating how, whenever you're choosing between two final alternatives, it could be choosing between two political candidates, between two prospective suitors to marry, between two cars to purchase. It doesn't matter. The process is one where it's a race to either reach the stopping threshold of alternative A or B. And once you reach that threshold, you stop. And that goes against the classical economic paradigm, which basically said you should have looked at all of the available and relevant information. Whereas a stopping threshold model says, no, you only look until you hit that threshold. How does that fit within the stuff that you did? Does it resonate with you?
No, that's very similar to work I've done in
I
medicine.
figured.
And Cornell has a very famous professor in sequential analysis called Bruce Turnbull. And so what he and others have been doing a lot is developing this for clinical trials. You have a randomized trials where you look whether a drug should be approved or not, or a vaccine or if a particular treatment. It could be a surgery. So you're experimenting, you random some patients to A and some patients to B. But you maybe have decided, okay, I'm going to recruit 1,000 people in each group. But you don't want just want to do that because you want to do intermediate analysis. So after you have 100 in each group, you might look at the data. And if it's very clear that this drug saves lives, you want to stop it and give
Yes.
everybody the drug. Or
Exactly.
if it's very clear that maybe this drug has some adverse reaction and people are getting heart attacks and dies, we also want to stop it because it's not a safe drug. So you do this interim analysis continuously during the trial, and sometimes you stop it early. And one of the things that I have done is during working with CDC and others is to use this concept in drug and vaccine safety. So CDC has a program called the Vaccine Safety Data Link. So I helped them develop the statistical methods and epidemiological methods for how to monitor the safety of this vaccine. So after it has been approved, you still want to monitor safety because there could be some rare but serious adverse reactions that didn't show up. So we got weekly data, and then from insurance from health plans. So we know all the kids who got the vaccine, and then we see, what do they have? Do they have a seizure on any days after it? And then we monitor every week, we get more data and we monitor it so that if there's a problem, we can detect it as soon as possible. And we use then these methods to sort of say, okay, we have to stop now because there's this alert that something might be wrong. Now, that
Wow.
could be that the vaccine is bad. It could also be that there were some data errors because statistics cannot distinguish between those two. But it's okay, we have to look into it now. And for example, we used this method when there was a new vaccine against measles. So there used to be measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, and then they got a separate shot for varicella, chickenpox. And Merck decided to have a combined one that combined all four in one needle because kids don't like needles. So they get one needle instead of two. But it turns out that this new vaccine, and when you gave it to 1-year-old, there was an excess risk of febrile seizures 7 to 10 days after the vaccine. And it's not a life-threatening thing, but you want to avoid it. So after 25,000 doses, we found this alert. And eventually, soon after, they sort of CDC changed the recommendations to not recommend it for 1-year-olds. So that's a very practical example where the public health benefits from what Wald, Abraham Wald, started
I
Amazing.
guess it's 70 years ago now, right? Yeah,
Yeah, or 80
1940s,
years ago
yeah.
now. Yeah, 80 years ago.
Well, it's going to be another jump here from sequential analysis to, I mean, I don't know if he was directly your colleague, but E.O. Wilson, who was a Harvard professor. I've often, did you ever meet E.O. Wilson, by the way?
I don't think I met him, no.
No, do you know who he?
I was just a simple graduate student when I was at Cornell, so
No, that's not. He
I
was
didn't
not.
meet.
He was
But
a Harvard biology professor.
oh, okay, sorry. No, I
Yeah,
haven't met him, no.
E.O. Wilson is a Harvard biologist who actually was injected into the culture wars, when we were, young children, because he is someone who introduced the ideas of sociobiology to study human affairs. And of course, as you probably know, Martin, most social scientists till today refuse to accept that human beings are biological creatures shaped by evolutionary forces, just like any other species. That's been much of my scientific career, has been trying to
Yeah.
incorporate evolutionary psychology in studying economic decision making, consumer decision making. Now, the reason why I'm raising E.O. Wilson is because he wrote a book, which maybe my viewers are tired of me promoting it, but he wrote a book in the late 90s called Consilience. And consilience is a beautiful word which refers to unity of knowledge. So, for example, physics is more consilient than sociology, not because physicists are inherently smarter than sociologists, but they have an organized, coherent tree of knowledge. And consilience is also about building bridges across disciplines. So, in E.O. Wilson's case, he was talking about how you could use evolutionary theory to understand phenomena in the humanities and the social sciences and the natural sciences. And the reason I'm mentioning all this is because my mind works at that synthetic level. I'm always trying to draw links between pieces that you should not be expecting there to be a link. And so, coming back to our discussion about sequential sampling, one of the things that has always interested me, I mean, I did write about it in several of my academic papers and so on, but I've thought about one day, maybe this is something we could work on together. I thought about writing one of those big meta papers demonstrating that that sequential sampling process applies across a bewildering number of areas that people typically wouldn't associate, right? So you hit me now with the medical trial example. I can show you how men and women use it to stop acquiring additional information and choose a mate or reject a mate. Now, that's a very, very different process than the medical sampling that you're talking about, but the fundamental stopping threshold is exactly the same. So, what do you think about that? Do you think that it would be a cool paper, one of those behavioral and brain sciences paper, those meta target papers where you demonstrate the ubiquity of sequential sampling across a bewildering number of human affairs?
I think that's fascinating, and I have thinking mostly in the health field. But you're right; those are everyday decisions. Well, it's not everyday decision to choose a spouse, but sort of common decisions. And in some cases, like a clinical trial, we put mathematical numbers on it. But even if we don't do that, in other things, the principles are the same. The sort of the
Exactly.
concept is the same. So I think
Exactly.
that's fascinating to sort of draw those parallels. And by the way, that's what good scientists do.
I've always thought I would love to be able have a machine where I could put a scientist and his consilience score comes out, right? Because in the same way that we now, okay, we can debate whether IQ captures intelligence and so on, but I mean, it just prima facie, of course, there's innate differences across people in terms of intelligence. Whether the IQ is the best measure or not, we can debate. I think it has done very well. So, in the same way that we have an IQ score, I would love to calculate a consilience score. And I'm willing to bet, as an open empirical question, that the higher my consilience score has to correlate with higher IQ. Because you wouldn't be able to draw those disparate links between these areas that most people had not thought about if you don't have that higher meta intelligence. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, but maybe there are different types of intelligence
Okay, fair enough.
because I think I am reasonably intelligent on certain things, but there are also some parts of life that I'm certainly quite stupid at.
Which reminds me of a joke. So although I think pretty technologically savvy, my brain shuts down when I have to do certain apps thing on my iPhone, like the parking app. So my wife will look at me and she says, "How is it that you can be so fancy in all your professorial career, but when it comes to just entering the app, which an average 7-year-old could do, you suddenly turn into a complete imbecile?" I go, those are the mysteries of life, sweetie."
Well, I'm smart in the way that when I buy a phone, I always get the same brand as my son, because that way I can ask him how it works. So my smartest is the choice of what phone to buy, and then I rely on him.
Gotcha. All right, let's talk about what is your future trajectory. So now you're out of Harvard. Do you have any interest in re-entering academia, or is it in your rear view mirror and we're moving on to bigger and better things?
Well, I'm still doing science. I have colleagues that enjoy working with me. I have never accepted money from the pharmaceutical industry, and I will never do that. So that door is
So
closed.
you're not going to industry. Okay.
No, I'm not going to do that. I work with colleagues who are grant funded and who likes to work with me. But also, I'm working with Scott Atlas and Jay Bhattacharya. I mean, the pandemic is now over, and COVID is endemic. It will be with us forever, but the pandemic is over, so that work is sort of done. But academia is in trouble, and I don't know if it will survive or not. I mean, there will always be universities and so on, but if we don't have academic freedom and freedom of speech, science is not gonna survive. It's not gonna, or the science will always be there, but the scientific community and the scientific process will slowly crumble and die. So I think it's important for us to try to put the scientific enterprise on this back on its track again. I think this problem with how funding is done is far too centralized. One of the problem with was that during the pandemic, Francis Collins sat on the biggest pile of research money in the world. And Anthony Fauci sat on the biggest pile of infectious disease research money in the world. People did not want to contradict what they said because they would put their livelihood at stake. So if you can have a more decentralized system, so instead of one NIAID, we have six. And if one is run by Fauci, we have at least five that are operating. We need to change how the scientific publishing process is done.
So in a
It's
sense,
in.
if I can analogize to how, there are three branches of governments in the US that serve as checks and balances against each other, in a sense, you're arguing for something similar, where you can't have a singular judge and executioner that sits on the pile of money. And if he's not happy with you, you're basically out of luck. That's basically what you're saying.
Yeah, we have like Sunetra Gupta sort of expert. We have a cartel system, not in science as a whole, but each little field of science is sort of a cartel with the leading people controlling the money and the publications and so on. And I think we saw during the pandemic, because there were some very important questions that we had, does mask work or not? How does transmission, does children transmit? Which is better, the infection acquired immunity or vaccine acquired immunity? What's the how long does the efficacy of the vaccine work? And those who came out with the first information about these critical questions, but not the scientific powerhouses of United States and the UK. It came from places like Denmark, like Qatar, Israel, Sweden, Iceland. There were excellent papers on the pandemic coming from these countries, and these are countries with very good scientists, so high quality scientists, but they are small and they have their own sort of funding mechanism. They are still in the same publication realm, so they are not completely isolated from this cartel system, but they are more independent. They are more on the fringe. So I think that's the reason why a lot of the good scientific papers came from these fringe countries, so to speak. They are fringe on the in the academic sense. They're not part of the US, UK
Yes, yes.
big powerhouses.
Interesting. In the answer that you gave, am I to read that, one of your next big projects is to contribute to the amelioration of the university ecosystem? Is that where you're going to throw your hat into the ring?
Yeah, we want to decentralize how academia operates, both both in the where the funding is very hard, but with scientific journals, we have now a few dominating scientific journals, and they failed us during the pandemic, whether it was Science or New England Journal of Medicine or British Medical Journal. They did not perform well during the pandemic. So we need a new system for scientific publications. And we have, I don't know if it's going to work, but we have to try to put the academic ship back on the right track again.
But I mean, to build on what you said, I mean, you're largely focused on the funding element, which of course is an important element. But I think there's even a more fundamental problem, and you'll tell me if you agree. So one of the things that I've noticed, and I mean, I'm a bit younger than you, but let's call us both at least 30 plus years as professors. What I've noticed, to my great chagrin and disappointment, is that many academics are actually not intellectuals in the true sense of the term. In other words, they are professional academics, they're careerists. So that to our earlier point of science as play, the true scientist, irrespective of which discipline he's in, he really is a child. He's looking, as you said, he's excited about the data. He, you know, right? I mean, I can sit and I mean, one of the reasons why my show has resonated so well with so many people is because you know, I'm able to sit down with the biostatistician epidemiologist and hopefully have a good conversation. But I could sit down with the classicist and have a good conversation. And I could sit down with the cosmologist and have a good conversation. Because again, to our earlier conversation point, I have a synthetic mind that allows me to navigate. I'm never going to know about epidemiology more than Martin, but I know enough about it that I can extract a lot of good stuff that we could have a conversation. And that comes from the fact that I am a full-blown orgiastic intellectual from A to Z. That's what I live all day long, whether I'm in my thoughts or I'm reading.
You
So
you're curious and you're open-minded.
I'm curious. Exactly. It seems though, so to ameliorating the university, so I'm going to come to that point. It seems as though the selection process by which we pick academics on many dimensions, it does well. Yes, they're smart and they got good grades and they entered good to a good graduate program. It would be nice if we could pick them in such a way that we truly know that they are intellectually pure in their curiosity, in their open-minded, that they're true honey badgers. I want my academics to be intellectual Navy SEALs, right? The Navy SEALs, we pick them on the fact that they're courageous and heroic and they will physically fight for us. I want my academic to do exactly that within the intellectual realm. But the reality, as I often say, and forgive me if those words offend you, most academics are part of a novel species, which I call the invertebrate castrati. Not only do they not have a spine, they don't have testicles. So when you end up with a species called academia, where most people are spineless and are testicle-less, that doesn't result in the openness and the debate and the confidence because everybody is worried about their little myopic careerist thing. Everybody's cowardly. Does that resonate with you? Is that what you've also picked up in your long academic career?
No, I think what you're saying is unfortunately true. And I mean, I have colleagues who have that curiosity, but I also see scientists for who is I think is a career. They worked hard in school, they got good grades, and they know how to
Play
sort
the
of
game.
move, not rock the boat and to sort of climb up. And I think it's especially true among people who go into administrative positions.
Exactly. Yeah.
In the rank and file scientist, I think maybe it's half and half. I don't know exactly, but there's certainly both types. But no, we have to also change our promotions criteria and so on. It shouldn't be about publishing as many papers you can in the fancy journals. It should be about new ideas and
Exactly.
try going out on a limb and trying new things. So we also have to change how promotions work and what we value in scientists.
And I'd like to say that, I mean, I appreciate your pessimism about academia in general, which of course I've been speaking about for many years, but I like to hopefully always also have some hope, some optimism. I do think that there are ways by which many of these perks and reward mechanisms could be changed rather rapidly. And some of these I've actually seen them within the lifespan of my own career. So, for example, when I first started going out into the public, right? I'm probably the first professor to set up a long form, podcast, or certainly one of the first. It's now been 10 years or more. I was probably the first or one of the first guys to go on Joe Rogan and so on. Well, all of these firsts, all my academic colleagues, including the, I tell the story in The Parasitic Mind in this book about how when I was invited to speak at Stanford Business School, my host at Stanford was, looked down that I would talk to people such as Joe Rogan. And I thought that was, bafflingly not only elitist, but suboptimal. What do you mean? You think it's not a good idea to talk about ideas with in front of 20 million people? You don't think that that's worthwhile? No. It's a lot more worthwhile to publish in a peer-reviewed journal that's going to be read by seven people, including your mom and girlfriend, right? But now a lot of the people who look down on, me becoming famous in the public eye and so on, will now write to me and say, "Oh, come to our famous university and teach us how to become popular like you are." So within a very few short years, within 10, 15 years, many of the people who used to look down on this public engagement and public outreach are now saying, "No, wait a minute." And you even see it in some of the metrics where, some of those portals will tell you how often has this academic paper been cited on Twitter and discussed it. So people are waking up to these things. So I'd like to think that yes, there are some sort of endemic and infrastructural problems in academia, but hopefully with a lot of hard work, we can change it. No? Are you as optimistic as I
No, I'm not quite as optimistic,
am?
but I'm happy that you are, and I hope you're right. I think we have to try whether it actually works or not. But there are positive things. I think it's always been one of the roles of scientists to actually engage with the public. That's obvious in public health, but I think it's true for all sciences. So that should be one of our roles, and some people might do it more than others, but that's fine. But I think certainly that should be one of our roles. But I think one thing that happened during the pandemic is that when people saw that they couldn't rely on the scientists because they know that something was wrong, they know that, well, why should I have the vaccine if I already have immunity? I learned about immunity a long time ago, so they knew that something was wrong. So a lot of regular people started to engage at a very high level with the science. And they will sometimes on Twitter, you will see a non-scientist, super smart, putting holes in the arguments of scientists. And of course, some of the scientists got very uncomfortable about that. Yes, and maybe
How
upset.
dare the great unwashed deal with us in the ivory tower?
So I know you're from Canada, and I have a lot of respect for you as a scientist, but I don't have the respect for all scientists. And I think in Canada, I would actually say that the truckers are probably smarter than the scientists.
I think I fully endorse that statement. Yeah, wow. All right. So what are you going to be if so you mentioned earlier Scott Atlas, whom I've also gotten to know very well, and Jay, is this going to be through the auspices that you're talking about through the Global Liberty Institute, or is this through Stanford Hoover Institution, or what is there a mechanism by which you guys are trying to
Yeah, so we're
ruffle?
collaborating with the Hillsdale in Michigan.
Oh, right.
So with the Academy for Science and Freedom. Yeah, the Liberty Institute is something else that Scott is doing. That's a great thing. So,
Oh,
but
that's wonderful.
that's sort of separate.
Oh, so do you you have some kind of position with Hillsdale? The reason I'm asking is because I was invited to speak at one of their functions in Naples, Florida, in February 2022, where I got to meet the president, Arne, and so on. And it just blew me away that their whole approach to things was just unbelievable. So maybe you could tell us a bit about your Hillsdale connection.
Well, so one thing that happens was that they Hillsdale were one of the few colleges that didn't close down. So that was a good thing. They sort of stood against the wind, and the wind was blowing pretty hard. And of course, they never had any vaccine mandates either. So they got it right. They are not a research university. They're a liberal arts college.
Sure.
They have students and faculty who are super smart. I'm very who sort of likes to think in different ways. So I think so we're trying to set up this. So I don't have a faculty appointment or anything like that with them. And this is not what that's about. This is sort of an academy that they are sort of helping us to launch very kindly.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, there is another school here, and to the president of that school, you're welcome at the promotion I'm giving you right now. New College of Florida. Have you heard of that school?
Yes, I know about that school. That's sort of a honors college, small honors liberal arts college in Florida. That's run by the, it's a state college, I think.
Exactly. And so, as you probably know, I mean, that school had started exactly as you said as an honors college. And then through the years, it got super wokeified. You know, if you're transgender and you have purple hair, you need to go to New College of Florida and so on. And then Ron DeSantis came in, tried to clean it up, de-wokeify it, brought in a new president. And so they're trying to now, I mean, I don't think they use those words. I'm using them on their behalf. I think they're kind of becoming or trying to become kind of the Hillsdale of the South, super classical liberal, you know, serious place. You could study whatever you want as long as it's wedded to reality and common sense and science and reason and so on. And so that might be something worthwhile for you to explore. I know that I've spoken to them. There might be some interesting partnerships that we do there. Anything else you want to promote, Martin, before we wrap this up? Of course, I could keep you here for another 4 hours, but I want to be mindful of your time. Anything you want to tell us about in terms of future projects?
No, thank you for a very pleasant conversation.
Oh, thank you. That was that
And
that.
not just pleasant, but fun and exciting. It's fun to talk about science. And I have done a number of interviews during this pandemic, but this is the first one I got to talk about sequential analysis. So.
Well, I feel very good about that. Thank you so much. It'll probably be up, I'm hoping, later today, both on YouTube channel and on my podcast, and I also directly posted on X as a means of trying to support Elon's platform. Not that he needs my small voice, but every small voice helps. Thank you so much. What a pleasure to meet you. I hope that I get to meet you in person soon. Please stay in touch. Stay on the line so we can say goodbye offline and come back anytime you'd like.
Thank you for having me.
Cheers.
This was fun. Yeah.